Ortega represents the door to a dark room. He doesn't want the door to open because he doesn't want you to see what's behind. He wants to stay in power.
It's been more than 3 months since protests began calling for President Daniel Ortega's resignation, and already Nicaragua has seen more than 300 deaths, hundreds more disappeared, and many more injured in clashes with police. Billions of dollars in corruption, a broken democracy, and a 2,000-strong paramilitary force props up the Ortega regime that's been 39 years in the making. How did this little Central American country get to be the region's latest flashpoint? I'm ASCOA Online's Elizabeth Gonzalez, and with our podcast host, Karin Zissis, out this week, I'll be presenting our latest Latin America in Focus podcast. I spoke with political analyst Javier Arguello about the measures Ortega has been taking since his first election in 1985, the role of the private sector in sustaining the status quo, and the potential for U.S. foreign policy to address the crisis. Arguello, who today lives in D.C., was born in Nicaragua to an apolitical family and a father that was a self-made businessman, pushed out during the Sandinista Revolution.
You're listening to Latin America in Focus.
Latinoamérica en Foco.
América Latina en Foco.
A podcast by America Society, Council of the Americas, on politics, economics, and culture in the region.
So I was born in León, Nicaragua, and this September was going to mark my 40-year anniversary of having been forced into exile. We were one of the first families, I guess, to be targeted by the Sandinistas in a revolution that started that year, 1978. And on September 13th, as I was a five-year-old, I made the mistake of opening the door to our house in León and finding a bazooka being lined up to blow us up. And I was not supposed to open the door. We were in the middle of a war. And as a five-year-old, I didn't know that. So my mother passed by, saw what was about to happen, and fainted. A few hours later, I think we escaped through a tunnel. Then we were stopped to be assassinated. And I guess this is one of the few instances in life where an uneducated police force that couldn't read was our blessing. And they didn't know they had captured us. So we clearly didn't say they had caught us. And they let us go. We migrated as political refugees to Washington, D.C. on September 13th of 1978. I came here as a five-year-old. And then I spent from then on to the age of 22, mostly in Washington, D.C., but also living in Central America at the time. And in 2005 or six, after a career as an executive with Citigroup working in different parts of the world, I truly felt a longing for roots and a desire to give back, and as well as a desire to understand the complexity of foreign policy towards the region and Nicaragua's inability to get back on its feet. So the summer that I was on sabbatical, I helped the State Department and this organization start a think tank. And in one of the first meetings, they said, listen, you've been elected the founding executive director of FUNIDES. So that was my second encounter with Nicaragua when I ran the think tank. Then I went back to school and I studied, you know, economic development, foreign policy. And I was completely disillusioned with Nicaragua and saw no prosperity in its horizon. And I stayed thinking, well, if I wanted to give back in a think tank, maybe what I can do is write and be an essayist and stay connected.
Okay, so Nicaragua has already been a crisis for 3 months. Protests first broke out in April 18th against the Social Security reform passed by the Sandinista government of Daniel Ortega. But soon after, the protesters just started demanding that he resign, and clashes between them and police and other pro-Ortega forces on the ground have left 300 people dead, according to international organizations. And some domestic human rights groups put that number at 400 at this point. Now, from an outsider's perspective, the situation in Nicaragua seemingly came out of nowhere and escalated very quickly. But it seems this, in fact, did not catch you by surprise. Where do you think it started turning?
That's a good question, because in terms of the, it didn't catch me by surprise that something that is not sustainable would eventually end, right? Because it simply wasn't sustainable. In terms of when and how it would end, I think it caught everyone, including myself, by complete surprise. I guess the profound disconnect that exists in Nicaragua, when you become a paranoid dictator that oppresses its people from afar, and is completely disconnected from the population that it oppresses, I think it's very easy for you to exist in an alternate world where you truly don't have your finger on the pulse of society, which is understandable for Ortega and his wife, who rules as vice president. So for them to be completely decoupled from reality is quite common for these brutal, oppressive regimes that tend to operate out of a bubble. What is, I think, catching the rest of society by surprise is that these are business leaders that historically considered themselves pro-free markets, anti-communism, anti-Ortega, anti his party that had been confiscated by him in the 80s, and traumatic experiences, bloodshed. Now, these people went from being strong opposition to dictatorial policies, populism, and the graft that goes along with it, to then basically saying, this is the best thing we've ever had. Nicaragua is the second most corrupt country in the hemisphere. That's a fact. Nicaragua is extremely unequal, where there are a few billionaires that do business directly with Ortega. So for these people, they were also disconnected from reality, and it makes sense. So who was not disconnected from reality? Well, students, the aging population, depending on the pennies they receive. And that's where I think it caught everyone by surprise, but everyone that's in a bubble.
Gotcha. And I definitely want to speak more about corruption and the private sector. But first, I'd kind of like to begin with how Ortega as a leader has changed himself, because, you know, when he first came to power after the Sandinistas took down Anastasio Somoza, his first five-year term between 1985 and 1990 was very different from when he came back in 2007. Back then he was, you would say, more liberal, and then he started implementing more conservative measures. In 2016, in his reelection, he outright banned the opposition. He allowed unlimited term limits for president by that point. So when did the authoritarian tendencies start changing the country?
I think we find that Ortega hasn't been that different. So the person that existed in terms of his character before becoming president is, you know, a textbook psychopath. He robbed a bank as a young man, and he raped his own daughter. He's a pedophile, a psychopath, an assassin.
To clarify, Ortega's stepdaughter, Soy La America, first went public with charges of sexual abuse by her stepfather in 1998. For the better part of two decades, she tried to bring her case in both domestic and international courts, but was never able to get the charges to stick.
He is the most qualified person to destroy a country, who we embarrassingly elected to become president with a minority of the vote. He had 38% of the vote in 2006 and became president. But the Ortega that reigned in the 80s, you could say, made the mistakes of confiscating and stealing property from the private sector, going against clergy and church, and being at war. And then you could say maybe he would have done a better job if he was wiser, older, and not at war. So, okay, we're in 2006, you get 38% of the vote through corrupt pact with the former president Alemán, who had stolen $100 million and was sentenced to prison. They were able to jointly change the constitution so that Ortega could become president with more than 35% of the vote, which is unheard of in the world. But at the time, we thought Alemán was as bad as things get. $100 million theft for a country whose GDP was $1 billion in 1990 is a lot, but it pales in comparison to what Ortega has done in the last decade. So when Ortega assumes power in 2006, this term begins in January of 2007, the first thing he does in 2008 is have municipal elections across the country, and he literally steals elections in 40 different municipalities. And this is the beginning of consolidating power. Then the second thing he does the following year, in 2009, it's rumored that at midnight on a Friday, he invites magistrates that are loyal to him to meet the following morning on a Saturday at 7 a.m. in order to enact legislation that allows for his reelection. So this is unconstitutional. So the Supreme Court or judicial power in Nicaragua does not have the authority to legislate. That would be the legislative power. So they basically, without having permission to do so, altered the constitution so that he could reelect himself. And then once he had a majority through a fraudulent election, then in 2014, the legislative body changed the constitution and made it effective retroactively in order to validate the fraud of 2012. So that is another unlawful. No constitution can be retroactively modified, right? So that's why he's an unconstitutional president. Then he took over all three branches of government and the police and military, which had already been institutionalized and were very professional. This was one of the few accomplishments we had in the 1990s, where they were supposed to be apolitical institutions meant to defend citizens. And what Ortega did was he first eliminated the five-year term limits so that they could be dictators alongside Ortega for life. Then he involved them in corruption, and that way you're guilty and you're one of me. And then he replaced the country with his party flag. So now you're loyal to the party, not the country. And because you're guilty, we don't have dissent. And then he takes over the media. He purchases basically every media outlet that he can. Over 80% of media is run by his family. So at this point, you've closed democracy. And then in 2016, it was not really an election. It was just like the one we had last May in Venezuela.
Nicaragua's Sandinista leader Daniel Ortega boasts that his third consecutive presidential election is in the bag. International observers have been banned in this election, and the main opposition party barred from running, leading to widespread charges that the election is a farce.
It's completely, a cooked election where the outcomes are known before the election takes place. So you couldn't be of another party. And what he did was he replaced the heads of the opposition parties with those with friends of his that were loyal to him.
What's interesting is that, you said that Nicaragua is the second most corrupt country in Latin America. And the last 4 years, the whole region has been touched by corruption scandals and started to root it out in cases like Brazil's Lava Jato. But Nicaragua hasn't been a focal point of that discussion these last few years. How widespread is it? Corruption and the private sector's role in it.
In Nicaragua, if you're honest, you're a fool. And if you try to run a business with integrity and or pay taxes, you're definitely anomalous. And the bigger the business, the more accurate that statement is. There is an umbrella chamber of commerce in Nicaragua that basically houses the 17 smaller chambers, right? So that's called COSEP. And COSEP has basically the captains of industry, who's who, at its helm. And these are the wealthiest Nicaraguans, the best connected Nicaraguans, the ones that have probably never paid a dollar of taxes in their life and have probably never ran a business without a great degree of corruption involved. Maybe that's a harsh statement for all of them, but it's certainly true for the majority. So what they did was they put at the head of COSEP its own little puppet that would legislate in their favor with Ortega behind closed doors. So it was no longer an open chamber that represented the economy. This was crony capitalism at its best. So the gentleman that ran COSEP, he's been there for over 10 years, right? And he has an academic advisor that comes to Washington and lobbies in favor of corruption that pretends to be an academic and is really an advisor to Ortega, an advisor to the elites in Nicaragua, and triangulates as a power broker. He's the former ambassador of Ortega in Washington, D.C., and he serves as a power broker to sustain the corrupt status quo, and this is what has caused everyone to say Nicaragua is a model for stability, for peace, for prosperity, for investments. It's where you want to be. Well, of course, until the party ends. And now what we see is the whole country is demanding for Ortega to be removed. And these people that have benefited from the corruption, the leaders of the private sector, they're nowhere to be found. Their opinion was extremely late, extremely soft. They've been absent from the dialogue. They haven't put pressure on the country.
Hundreds of thousands of people took to the streets of Managua in the largest anti-government protest in decades. The demonstration was organized in solidarity with the mothers of students and peaceful demonstrators who have been killed by police and pro-government militias since the start.
On May 30th, which was the terrible massacre on Mother's Day, some of these COSEP leaders came out and called for early elections, and they rejected the human rights violations. And many people said that represented a break between the private sector and the Ortega government. You don't think that was the case?
That's true. That was a synchronized communique that came out on Mother's Day by a few of these captains of industry that was a day late and a dollar short, in the sense that everyone said the same thing. They were all incredibly light. They were all incredibly synchronized. They were all terribly late, and they have all been absent ever since. Since May 30th, we've had maybe a 500% increase in violence, in deaths, in disappearances, in torture. They've not said anything that I'm aware of yet. The way I see this is as a metaphor where Ortega represents the door to a dark room. He doesn't want the door to open because he doesn't want you to see what's behind. He wants to stay in power. And this door is held to the wall with a few hinges. And the hinges are the people that triangulate between the corruption and the status quo in Nicaragua. So Maduro and Chavez were sending Ortega oil. And up until recently, you know, prices were high and Venezuela could afford it. So it's demonstrated that about $5 billion are missing. So what Ortega did was monetize the oil and privatize into his own pocket and into his own kind of businesses the revenue that he generated from the oil, because he doesn't have to pay back the Venezuelans for the next 40 years through loans that will stay as debt. So he basically privatized public debt and put it in his pocket. He owns about 70% of the country's energy. Do you think that the private sector would not say anything if they were being hurt by Ortega in the last decade? It doesn't make any sense. So in Nicaragua, it's a deeply polarized society where we tend to be either extreme left or extreme right across what I call the horizontal axis of political ideology. I always say this horizontal axis is completely irrelevant. The one we care about is the vertical axis of governance. And when there's corruption, political ideology is completely irrelevant. And in Nicaragua, the left and the right are tied at the bottom in a very deep pool of corruption. And that's why political ideology is something that you're basically agnostic to when you're benefiting economically. So the people that are not benefiting economically are fighting over political ideology, while the people that are benefiting from corruption are not even discussing political ideology, they're just benefiting economically.
But economic activity has certainly taken a hit for the last 3 months, especially, well, because there's basically a curfew in place, right? People are home by 6 p.m. Additionally, the Civic Alliance, which is the opposition group of students and farmers and other civil society, have organized multiple nationwide strikes asking for businesses to close down. You don't think that the private sector has taken that cue, or are they doing anything about that? Do they care? Is that not enough to, you know, make a budge in their pockets?
When you say, do they care, that shows emotion. These people don't have emotion, but they care about their money. And they care deeply right now because definitely it's hurting their pocketbook. The problem is it's a bit of a checkmate. They cannot publicly denounce their former partner. They don't have weapons to go to war, nor would it be desirable. They can't really ask the U.S. to investigate themselves. They could be caught there. So I think opportunism is just silently waiting to find the next opportunity in weak institutions and the next president they can bribe. That's the history of the country. There is no honest past in Nicaragua. What country on earth has recovered from this level of poverty combined with corruption? None, in any continent. So why would we be the first? Especially without justice. That just doesn't happen.
And that's exactly why the opposition is demanding that there be, you know, justice. And they're basically not leaving any other option besides Ortega resigning. If we can just move on and cover really quickly the national dialogue, which, you know, the private sector, COSEP, was supposed to play a role in, but you say they've been pretty absent. I mean, the national dialogue started May 16, but it's been on and off and currently suspended since a bishop was injured earlier this month. And the government is not sitting at the table and they're refusing to accept early elections in March of next year. Do you think that there should be a greater effort to have a national dialogue? Could this be a possible way out?
In theory, you would assume that a dialogue is the way to go. And the clergy can't recommend the status quo, nor can they recommend violence. It basically leaves them with one option, dialogue. It's not rational to say, I want war, and it's not rational to say, I want the status quo. So dialogue is the only option. But a dialogue requires good faith on both sides. If we know something about Ortega, I mean, the Senate actually did a study of the extent of his broken promises. They couldn't find a single instance where he kept a promise. There will not be good faith on his behalf. So he derailed the dialogue. He was slow to show up. Then he only went once. Then the real dialogue was happening behind closed doors. He sent people that had no power. It would really not happen frequently. He said, I'm not stepping down. So it was a fake dialogue. It was designed to fail. And that was foreseeable. The problem is, what's next? Because how do you get out of this? So part of it is, it says, you know, violent uprisings are less likely to be successful than peaceful ones. This has been a peaceful one, but the government is murdering people. It's the police have a shoot to kill order. And if you try to quit the police, they kill you. That's a fact. You cannot remove yourself from the violence if you report to the government. So this is as bad as it gets, and deaths are escalating, and there's no end in sight. I've always said, you know, peace and time are enemies of change. This had to be quick, and it had to be violent on behalf of the government, because if it's violent on behalf of the government, then we can hopefully get the world's attention, and it's desperately needed in Nicaragua. The problem is that there isn't, you know, back to darkness here, there hasn't been an example that I'm aware of in modern history where the international community has responded in time to genocide. Nowhere. Not Rwanda, not Serbia, not Equatorial Guinea, not Sudan, not Nicaragua, not Venezuela. It just doesn't happen.
Right. It wasn't until this month that the OAS had that resolution with 21 countries condemning the violence and asking for early elections.
Exactly. And even that was terribly slow. And what teeth does that have? So Ortega can do what Maduro did in Venezuela. He could just say, okay, that's great. Just get me out of your organization. Now what?
Yeah, we've seen that it's been really difficult to figure out how to deal even with Venezuela through them. And there have been multiple resolutions and meetings on the issue, and yet not much comes out of those meetings. Do you think that getting the U.S. to take a stronger stance would be helpful at all? Because they've already sanctioned three different officials. They were one of the countries to sign the OAS resolution.
Today, on behalf of President Trump, we call on Daniel Ortega to end his government's crimes and answer for his nation's cry for democracy and human rights. The time has come to end the attacks on peaceful protesters. The time has come to give the Nicaraguan people the future of freedom they deserve.
That was Vice President Mike Pence in June. So what's the United States policy toward the country?
I think that U.S. foreign policy is the last hope for positive change in Nicaragua. And I think if the United States foreign policy fails to enact legislation with teeth that actually can do something, we will start seeing 700,000 Nicaraguans come to the U.S. In the 1980s, during the conflict, Nicaragua's population was less than half of what it is today, and about 12% of the population ended up in the United States. That was 250,000 people or so. Right now, the population is getting close to 7 million. If you have 12% migrate again, you can see over 700,000 Nicaraguans leaving. There is already a mass exodus of Nicaraguans fleeing the country. I asked friends that have kids or married, you know, what percentage of you are sending your kids abroad? And the answer that I get from everyone is 100% of those that can afford to send their families out have already done so or are trying to do so. There isn't a single person that's keeping their kids there. So what do I mean by U.S. foreign policy being the last hope? So I historically have been critical of foreign policy in Latin America, where it has been either excessive in force or too absent in smart diplomatic power. And I think that a balance that is strategic, surgical, smart with policies and sanctions is usually better than turning your back or shooting. And I think that the time is opportune for the U.S. to finally take the NICA Act out and allow Senate to vote. The Foreign Affairs Committee has held it for a long time.
The NICA Act was introduced into Congress at the end of 2016 after Ortega's re-election in November and in preemption of the municipal elections in November this year. A second version of the bill was sent to the Senate in April and has been criticized for threatening the IMF and the World Bank's ability to give loans to Nicaragua, one of the poorest countries in the region. But these are the very loans Arguello argues Ortega is misappropriating. Here's what it entails.
So there are basically 6 points within the NICA Act. It seeks to have free, fair, and transparent elections, which should be overseen by credible councils, which has not been allowed in the past. This includes international electoral observers, of course, which makes sense, right? So secondly, it seeks to promote democracy. And here it asks specifically for a separate judicial system and a separate electoral council. Both have been hijacked by Ortega. Third, it needs to restore the rule of law. Fourth, it wants to respect the right to free association and freedom of speech, which is basic in, you know, in any society. And fifth, it wants to combat corruption, which is really important. We cannot build a democracy over a foundation of corruption. And finally, six, it wants to protect the right to form political opposition, which was completely eliminated by Ortega. It wants to allow journalists, trade unions, human rights defenders, and civil society activists to operate really without interference. So that's the spirit of the law. And it would do so by implementing sanctions and blocking assistance from bilateral and multilateral organizations. And what I've always said is, as a U.S. taxpayer, you are funding the assassination of innocent people, because indirectly we're giving Ortega aid that he misappropriates and uses for violence.
One of the officials already sanctioned was the Nicaragua's National Police Commissioner. I'm highlighting that because I wanted to point out the different roles that the military and the police have been playing in the crisis so far, and the paramilitary forces that Ortega refuses to acknowledge. He, on July 23rd, had an interview with Fox News. It was the first unscripted interview since 2009, and there's just no way that he would recognize these as paramilitary. He kept saying that these were opposition groups that were too violent and responsible for the bloodshed.
Mr. President, why are paramilitary forces involved in armed actions against those who are protesting your government?
These are groups that obey political organizations. Some even have elected deputies to the National Assembly. They are members of the Liberal Party. Others did not participate in the elections. They refused to do that, and they've been organizing these paramilitary groups for some time now, and they have taken advantage of every small situation in launching attacks.
When it comes to the police, there have actually been, you know, photos where you see police on armed trucks with military-grade weapons and with other masked gunmen. Like, they are clearly working together. But does the military remain separate from that, given that they voiced opposition to the repression earlier on?
Francisco Diaz is the head of the police, de facto head of the police. He is also the father of a lady that is married to Daniel Ortega's son. So they are family. The police is definitely behind all of the violence. And the paramilitary groups that report to Ortega, the antimotines, these are about 2,000. There's no doubt. This has been verified by every single observer internationally. There are no arms on behalf of the peaceful protest from the other side. And if it's true that Ortega is not behind them, why couldn't he denounce them on Fox News and say, I need help. I'm being attacked by paramilitary groups. I denounce their violence. He has never agreed to denounce the violence that he controls and directs, because that, you know, would be used against him. So he avoided that question. Now, in terms of the military, this was run up until a while ago by Humberto Ortega. This is Daniel Ortega's brother. And he's still the father figure behind the military. He has sought to separate himself, but he's still consulted with and they're aligned. And what the reason why the military has not been killing people, or at least not blatantly, is because they are an economic power in and of themselves. They're a $400 million economic group. So they don't want to hurt their own pocketbook, and they care more about their empires than anything else. They haven't had the guts, I guess, to defend citizens. So they're violating their constitutional right. And I think it's the Article 92 of the Constitution of Nicaragua demands that they protect the sovereignty of the people of Nicaragua. And when those are under attack, it's their right to defend Nicaraguans. I've been saying this for a while, and because at first people were saying, thank God the military is not killing us as well. And my first reaction was, that's not good enough. They actually have to defend you.
Now, this anti-terrorism law that the Congress just passed on July 16th, international organizations have expressed worry that this vaguely defines what a terrorist is, and therefore they fear that it opens the possibility to persecute protesters, calling them terrorists. What are the implications of that?
Yeah, it's terrible. So to raise the level of violence and intimidation, they did basically two things recently. They, apart from, you know, giving police and paramilitary groups the right to shoot to kill and no questions asked. I mean, you basically, in Nicaragua now, you have cases where a one-year-old dies from a bullet wound to the head. And when you see the autopsy report, the claim made is that it was suicide. So, I mean, the extreme cynicism and violence has no limit in Nicaragua. And the two things that have happened recently, what you described as the anti-terrorist rules. So everyone that says something negative about the government is deemed a terrorist. I think you can be guilty of thought in Nicaragua. If the police thinks that you're thinking negative thoughts about the government, they have the right to kidnap you, to beat you, to possibly shoot you. You disappear, you're tortured. That's absolutely fine. You cannot have negative thoughts about the government. That's illegal. So we have our little North Korea now in Central America. And on top of that, what he has, Ortega has been trying to do more recently is violate the privacy that banks have so that he can access people's bank accounts. He wanted to know who was wiring money where. And he has already begun to confiscate properties, which he did at the end of his regime in the 80s. And that was a famous piñata, which is what it was called, where he basically looted government and stole private property. So now he's been telling the most impoverished Nicaraguans to please take over land and squat in different farms throughout the country.
Nicaraguans have already taken out some $750 million from banks.
Yeah, I don't know what the most recent figure is, and I suspect that it's more. And in addition to that, Ortega raised the liquidity requirements by 50%. So it's a double pinch on the banks because they're seeing a run on the on their deposits while requiring increased liquidity. So it's hard to know where the money's coming from. And this is why, you know, drug traffic has been a monopoly run by Daniel Ortega, proven. I mean, there are drug flows reports that the United Nations produces every 5 years. I analyzed those carefully and looked at the percentage of cocaine that flows through Nicaraguan's borders, and it represents 14% of Nicaraguan GDP. So in the United States, only 1.5% of people consume cocaine. You'd say no big deal. The real business isn't in stopping cocaine, it's in selling arms. So who cares about this, you know, perpetual war on drugs? Well, yeah, you do care. The reason why you care is because it increases violence when the monopoly ends. If you think about, if you're guilty of thoughts, if the financial system can collapse, if you can be killed, you're likely to migrate.
And typically, Nicaragua was one of the countries in Central America that was better off in terms of violence and was not among the Northern Triangle countries that have been sending all these kids on their own to the U.S.-Mexico border. Well, it's been a very interesting conversation, Javier. Thank you so much for your time and for your insights.
Sure. Thank you, Elizabeth, for the opportunity.
Thank you for listening. I'm Elizabeth Gonzalez, and I produce this podcast. The music in this podcast was recorded at America Society in New York City. Find out about upcoming concerts at musicoftheamericas.org. We hope you enjoyed this podcast. If so, write us a review and subscribe at iTunes, Google Play, SoundCloud, and Stitcher.